15. Martin and Philip materialized in the gray morning sky above a pasture in Wales. This was their preferred method of arrival in a new place. Appearing at ground level might alarm the locals, and you always ran the risk of materializing in the middle of someone's bedroom, campfire, or wall, all of which would alarm them even more. Of course, two men popping into existence out of thin air, then hovering in that same thin air, tended to alarm people pretty badly as well, but at least they would be alarmed at a distance. Philip and Martin drifted gently to the ground and looked around for a moment, before Martin said, "I expected to see dragons."
"Yes," Philip said. "That was rather the point. I'm not surprised that we didn't appear right on top of them, mind you, but I didn't expect there to be no obvious sign that they're around."
"Yeah, I figured if we didn't see the dragons, there'd be fire or shouting."
"I suppose we should be grateful that there isn't."
"Yes, but it makes our job harder." Martin switched his staff to his left hand and held his right out before him. Philip saw and asked,
"What are you doing?"
"Calling Jeff to complain." Martin said,
"Communique kun Jeff."
And after a few rings, a flickering image of Jeff's disembodied head appeared floating in his hand.
"Oh, what now?"
Jeff cried.
"Nothing too bad," Martin assured him. "It's just that the dragons aren't exactly where you sent us."
"Sorry. There are a lot of time and distance variables. You should be pretty close."
"It might help us track them down if we had a copy of that dragon map you had."
"Of course, you're right. I'll figure out a way to make copies for all of the teams. Something you can use in front of people without having to explain what a smartphone is. I'll have it to you as soon as possible."
Martin thanked Jeff and ended the call. He turned to Philip and said,
"Really, it seems like the kind of thing he should have thought of himself."
"Yes," Philip said. "I suspect the stress of the situation is getting to him. Frankly, the rest of us should have thought of it as well."
"Yeah, I suspect the stress is getting to us, too. Nobody wants to be remembered as having had any part in all life on Earth being slowly smothered by artificial dragons."
"I suppose the one bright side to all life on Earth ending is that there's nobody left to remember who is responsible."
Martin asked, "Have I ever told you that you always know the perfect thing to say to cheer me up?"
"No, you haven't."
"Good." Philip took a few steps, planted his staff, and bent down to examine the ankle-length grass.
"Coming down, I noticed a big dark streak going through the field. It's harder to see this close, but this is the edge of it. It's like a big patch of the grass has been disturbed. A group of four dragons walking through might do that."
Martin's surprisingly distant voice said,
"Yeah, and it might do that, too."
Philip looked up and saw that Martin had already walked away along the path of the dark streak, but had stopped to answer and to point his staff at a dark hole in the tree line caused by broken branches. The streak of disturbed grass led directly to it. Martin started walking again.
"That might be the wrong way," Philip shouted.
Martin stopped again and turned back to Philip.
"The other direction might be the wrong way, too."
"True, so it's a 50-50 chance. Why pick that way over this one?"
Martin said,
"Well, the dragons appeared in places there were already sheep, right? So this is a pasture. There's more pasture behind you. This way leads into the woods. I don't think sheep usually live in the woods. It seems more likely that they would have appeared in the pasture and headed into the woods than the other way around."
Philip shrugged, then walked to catch up with Martin. The two set off on foot in the direction of the gap in the trees. Martin said,
"The guys were surprised when you suggested that you and I make one team and Britt and Gwen make another."
Philip said.
Yes, well, the guys are all single, aren't they? They probably haven't learned yet that one of the secrets of getting someone to stay with you is giving them plenty of time when they're not actually with you.
Yep, you've gotta leave them wanting more.
Or at least give them enough space that they don't start wanting less. You'll notice that neither Gwen nor Britt argued with the idea.
Yeah, I did notice that. I also noticed that Britt insisted on taking Scotland.
Yes, not surprising. It has the largest single group of dragons. Sadly, women often have to take on the most daunting challenge merely to be seen as an equal.
True, Martin said. But are you sure that's why she took Scotland?
Why else would she?
I don't know. It's just interesting. When you think of Scotland, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Bagpipes.
Okay, then what?
Accents.
Fine, what else?
Haggis?
Martin rolled his eyes. Philip asked,
Look, Martin, what are you getting at?
Martin said, Kilts. Most people think of kilts. Philip shrugged.
So?
Martin said, The big sweaty beefcakes who do all of the work in Atlantis. They wear kilts, don't they?
Yes, they do. What are you trying to say, Martin?
Britt the Elder designed Atlantis. Did she pick uniforms for the workers? And if so, does something happen in Scotland now that makes her want to be around men in kilts when she designs Atlantis later?
I suppose it's possible, if you believe that they're the same person.
And you don't?
No, I don't.
Because you believe in free will?
Yes, I do.
And Britt the Elder, truly being Britt the Younger from the future, would mean that Britt the Younger has no free will.
Indeed.
After a few more steps, Martin said, Of course, if she doesn't really have free will, it would make the whole men in kilts question meaningless. It would mean that no matter what happened, she never chose to be around men in kilts.
Perhaps not.
She was irresistibly compelled to be around men in kilts. Philip shouted,
Shut up!
And Martin did shut up, because it's hard to talk while laughing. They walked through the dark hole broken into the forest edge where they presumed the dragons had gone. They could see down the path ahead, but tree trunks and undergrowth limited their visibility. The path appeared to have existed before the dragons came along, but the dragons seemed to have widened it, roughly shoving the foliage away on all sides as they walked through. Unfortunately, much of the displaced debris had fallen directly on the path, so Martin and Philip had to watch their step. They didn't know if the dragons had split up, then doubled back. Without discussing it, they knew that a dragon could come crashing through the wood at them at any moment, from any direction. Without warning, they heard a trumpet fanfare emanating from an empty spot in the air above Martin's head. The instant the fanfare ended, a rolled piece of parchment appeared in midair. Martin caught it as it fell, then unrolled it. The map itself was useless. When zoomed down to a local level, it showed roads, rivers, and castles, all drawn in a charming style, but they did not and could not correspond to any existing landmarks in the real world. Instead of drawing a map from scratch, Jeff had just used an image of the board game Carcassonne, which looked enough like a map to fool the casual medieval observer. The important parts were a stick figure drawing of a wizard that obviously signified their current position, and various red dots connected to the wizard by lines, and marked with a number that appeared to be the distance between the two in meters. Two dots crowded along the border of the map, well behind the wizard figure. The numbers showed that these two dragons were thousands of meters away from Martin and Philip, and each other. The other four dots were all within a few meters of each other, and only a couple hundred meters away from Martin and Philip.
Those dragons are close, Martin said. That's good news.
Is it?
Asked Philip. They continued walking, following the trail as it meandered through the woods.
I'm glad we got this map, Martin said, rolling it up and placing it in his robe pocket. We might have been looking all day.
They heard a rustling in the distance, coming from the trail ahead. Not nearly loud or violent enough to be a dragon approaching, but loud and violent enough to give the wizards pause. They stopped in their tracks, held their staffs forward, and prepared for whatever was headed their way. After a few tense seconds of ever-intensifying noise, a man ran around the bend. He was a short, stout, older man in new leather breeches and a woven tunic. He had fear in his eye and a sword in his hand. He looked like he had much more experience with the fear than he did with the sword. He skidded to a stop, looked at Martin and Philip, and asked,
Are you wizards?
Martin tensed a bit. Philip said,
Yes, we are wizards.
The man said,
Oh, thank the heavens!
He dropped his sword, stepped toward them, and in a beseeching voice said,
I need your help.
Philip asked,
What's troubling you that you need a wizard's help?
Dragons! I'll show you! Follow me!
Martin said, Huh. Maybe we didn't need the map so badly after all. The man feared dragons, but he didn't seem concerned that the dragons would hear him. He talked the entire time he led the wizards to the problem.
Look, gentlemen, what you're about to see, it's, look, it's going to surprise you. I need your help, no two ways about it, but I'm trusting you to be men of honor. I'm not averse to paying a fair wage for fair work, and greed is a sin, but I hope we can all agree that what's mine is mine, and to take it away would be stealing.
Martin and Philip exchanged an amused but weary look. Philip said,
My good man, I'm sorry. What's your name?
Neith.
Neith, we are wizards. We can bend, shape, and manipulate the very fabric of reality as if it were so much...
Philip trailed off, looking for the right word.
Fabric?
Martin offered.
Yes. I promise you we have no interest in stealing whatever it is we're about to see.
Neith said,
I'm glad to hear that, because we're almost there. It's just inside this cave.
The path had led them to the side of a steep hill. Set into the hill, they saw a dark, gaping hole. It resembled what Martin imagined a giant's upper lip and mouth would look like when viewed from a giant spoon. Neith disappeared into the cave without stopping to make sure the wizards were still following, which they weren't. Philip and Martin looked at the cave dubiously.
Martin, can you think of a single example of someone finding something in a cave that they were happy about afterward?
No, but maybe we'll be the first.
Martin, can you think of a single example of something pleasant happening to the two of us first?
Philip walked into the cave, not waiting for an answer. Martin followed. Martin muttered a spell to turn his staff into a flashlight, then said, That's better. The inside of a cave looked exactly as Martin had expected it would. Rough rock walls curving seamlessly into a rock ceiling over a bed of wall-to-wall dirt, all enlivened by the decorative flourishes for which bats are well known. The cave stretched out ahead of them, remaining surprisingly roomy as it curved out of their view. Philip stopped him.
That fellow, Neith, he didn't need a torch.
Maybe he knows the cave really well. He might spend a lot of time here.
We've been lured into a cave by a man who spends lots of time in said cave. Splendid. I only hope we don't come to regret his home cave advantage.
Neith emerged from around a bend in the distance, begging them to hurry. Only when they had him as a visual reference did they realize that the cave had maintained its full height. Also, Now that they looked at it critically, the cave seemed far too long and straight, and the radius of the curved ceiling was too regular for a naturally occurring geological formation. The cave appeared man-made, or more likely, wizard-made. They followed the man around the bend and into a large chamber the size of a small basketball arena, filled with gold. Not the large, loose heaps of gold like comic book artists and theme park ride set designers are fond of creating, but countless tall, neat, orderly stacks of gold objects, carefully sorted, organized, and stored in their assigned places, with large golden signs specifying what went where. And the items were not coins, goblets, and crowns, as one might expect. The sign next to several rectangular stacks of thin gold plates said, "Shingles." Looking around the room, they saw many rectangular stacks of a variety of solid gold slabs, marked with signs saying, "Tile floor," "Tile wall," "Tile ceiling," "Siding," "Paneling," and "Flashing." They also saw golden bins full of golden nuts, bolts, nails, and screws, and stacks of solid gold I-beams, railings, balusters, and posts, all of it illuminated by the kind of lights one would expect to find hanging from the ceiling of a Home Depot, only they were floating in midair, and made of gold. Philip said,
"Jimmy."
Martin was rendered speechless by the sheer amount and strange forms of the gold before him, and by the sight of the four sleeping dragons draping themselves over the stacks of priceless building materials, like cats making themselves comfortable in a room full of cardboard boxes. Philip said,
"We all knew that Jimmy went somewhere to make materials for Castle Camelot. It's not like you can pop down to the lumber yard for a solid gold 2x4.
Martin said, "Yeah, it makes sense that he create a stockpile so the work could go on without his supervision. He probably set up a portal into this cave for his workers."
"Yes, and when the castle was done, Jimmy wouldn't have destroyed the surplus material. It's gold. For all we know, he went looking for this cave when we exiled him."
"Nah, you're giving Jimmy too much credit."
"You don't think he'd have remembered where this cave was?"
"No, I don't think he could have ridden from Argentina to Wales on a bicycle."
"Good point."
Philip tapped Neith on the shoulder, distracting him from staring in anguish at his gold being used as a bed by dragons.
"How long have the dragons been in here?"
Philip asked.
"A little over 2 days."
"How did they get here?"
"They were drawn to the gold."
"Really?" Martin asked. "Are you sure?"
"Yes, absolutely. I was out for a walk, coming to check on my gold, and in a big clearing on the way I saw the dragons. I thought to myself, they're clearly after my gold, so I tried to shoo them off, but they wouldn't leave. Then I ran all the way here to try to protect my gold from them."
"And they followed you?"
Philip said.
"No, I outran them."
"All the way into the gold chamber?" Martin said.
"Yes,"
Neith answered proudly. Philip asked,
"And you say they haven't left this room once since they got here?"
"No, sir, they haven't."
Philip turned to Martin and said,
"Good. Seems these four neutralized. We can just throw a goal up in the cave leading out, go destroy the other two dragons that have been assigned to us, and with any luck, these four will have taken care of themselves by the time we return."
"Wait,"
Neith said.
"What do you mean, destroy the other two dragons? You two are here to destroy the dragons anyway?"
"Yes," Martin said. Neith said,
"Oh, could I trouble you, please, to take care of these four first, since you're here already?"
Philip shook his head.
"I really think it would be easier if we leave them for later."
"But I'd rather have them gone now. If you kill them first, I can make it worth your while."
Martin asked,
"How?"
Neith said,
"I can pay you in gold."
We're wizards, Philip said. We can make our own gold.
But if I give you gold, you won't have to.
Martin shook his head. But you don't have any gold. From where I'm standing, the dragons have the gold, not you.
Yes,
Neith said brightly.
So the sooner you get rid of the dragons, the sooner I can pay you.